Before there was money, there was debt, boldly states David Graeber in his book Debt, The First 5,000 Years. Now, Graeber brings a lot to the table. He's considered one of the world's leading anarchists. He's a professor of anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London. And he's one of the founders of that little thing called Occupy Wall Street. Graeber says all those experiences help him understand the role of debt in our lives. Steve Paulson was intrigued. He asked why Graeber believes we can't afford to be middle class anymore. That is, without going into debt.
It has to be. You really can't pursue. I mean, you can live a basic life in terms of providing food for yourself, providing some kind of housing, maybe medical care. If there's catastrophic medical needs, it probably won't be covered. But if you want to go beyond that, if you want to send your kids to college, if you want to have some chance of advancing in life, which has become something increasingly, a prospect that seems increasingly distant to so many American families, you basically have to go into debt. And also, if you want to have a social life, I mean, what most of that money that is borrowed, it doesn't go to people's personal luxuries. It goes to things like your grandfather's birthday party, because these sort of social events are things which are not, you know, which are time sensitive. You need the money at a certain time, and that's why people go into debt, even beyond their income. You know, they say, why do they borrow the money if they could have waited? Well, usually it's because there's some pressing social need. It's your daughter is only going to be 12 once.
Well, it raises the question of whether there's always a problem with debt, or whether debt is, maybe we should just accept, this is just part of life. It's a necessary part of life, both on a personal level, because occasionally, we need the money to pay for something that we want, or at a societal level, maybe debt is necessary to fuel economic growth.
Well, I mean, that's the assumption of people like the Federal Reserve. There has to be a certain inflation rate. There has to be a certain lending rate. This is the case. The problem is that debt has an historical tendency to go out of hand. And that's especially true in historical periods like we have today. It was one of the most striking things that I discovered when I started doing a long-term history of debt is, first of all, that virtual credit money, we talk about we're entered this domain of virtual money with cashless transactions as if this is something new, which is made possible by computers and has never existed before. What I discovered is this is not the case at all. Coinage was invented perhaps 600 BC, but you can go back 2,000 years before that and find people with fluctuating interest rates, the equivalent of expense accounts, bar tabs. People are actually using money, but money is for the most part virtual credit money. People are not actually using cash of any sort. They didn't even have coins, and they didn't even bother making scales sort of accurate enough to weigh out the tiny amounts of silver you'd have to spend if you wanted to buy a chicken or something like that. Clearly, people were doing things on credit in ancient Mesopotamia, for example. Well, you have this back and forth. Then cash comes in, and you have a period of time, roughly maybe 600 BC to 600 AD, where people actually are using cash in everyday transactions. Middle Ages, it disappears. People go back to credit again. That's when the checks are invented. It's an Arabic thing, actually, check. They're using paper money in China. They're using tally sticks in Europe. So you have credit again. And around the time of Columbus, suddenly you have this infusion of gold and silver, and people go back to a bullion-based economy again. That's ending now. But it's a back and forth. Now, what you always find in periods dominated by what we would now call virtual credit money, such as we have today and have had since roughly 1971 when Nixon went off the gold standard, is some kind of mechanism to make sure things don't go out of hand and the people who do have access to credit don't end up enslaving everybody else. The great social nightmare of antiquity was exactly that, that a tiny percentage of the population would effectively reduce everyone else to slaves. They would fall into debt traps. They couldn't get out. They'd lose their lands. They'd lose their flocks. They'd have to sell their wives and children into slavery. The way to head that off was always to provide some kind of mechanism, cut things off when they started to get crazy.
Are you talking about forgiving the debt at a certain point?
Precisely. That was one of them. In the really ancient world, in Mesopotamia, they would simply cancel the debts. Often they would cancel consumer debts and not commercial debts. Every new king often in Mesopotamia would simply say, okay, clean slate, start over again, debts are canceled.
Well, why would they do that, though? I mean, they stand to lose a lot if they cancel the debts.
they stand to lose even more if they don't, because what would happen is society would be thrown into utter chaos. People would start fleeing their farms because terrified their creditors were going to take everything away. Large parts of the population would end up servants or slaves in other people's households. So you'd have a few rich people basically eating up everybody else, and the kings would panic. Society would fall apart. There would be unrest. People would run off and become desert nomads to escape. So really, the fear was of total social breakdown, and the dangers of slowing the economy because people would be afraid to lend money were far less than the consequences of not doing it. Similarly, biblical jubilees, they institutionalized every 7 years or 49, depending on the reading. They would simply cancel debts and start over again.
Hmm. And you've said that we should resurrect that idea of the jubilee. We keep hearing about countries that are in serious debt, and you're saying maybe it's time just to cancel those debts.
Well, I think it would be a way of reminding us what kind of world we really live in. Because another thing I discovered in looking at the history of debt is that debts are always negotiable. They're not really sacred. What they are is a promise. Now, it is true that one's honor is bound up in promises, but when you think about it, promises almost by definition are renegotiated or can be renegotiated if they are between two honorable people and their situation changes. The strange thing about debts is that once you enter, you know, once numbers enter in, once you can quantify exactly who owes what to whom and how much, they become impersonal. You don't have to think about the other person's situation, and you can transfer them. Of course, if I make you a promise, you can't give that promise to someone else, but a debt you can. In a way, that's all that money is. It's circulating promises, circulating debts. Now, when it is a matter of debts between rich and powerful people, this is what happens anyway. I mean, we saw it in 2008, of course, when AIG is several trillion dollars in trouble or whatever it was. Well, they figure something out. They play around with the numbers. They adjust things. They do something with the Federal Reserve. Suddenly, the debt's gone.
And because the assumption was that AIG was too big to let fail. I mean, there would be catastrophic repercussions if they just went out of business. So, okay, let's figure something out.
Exactly. That's the excuse. But as I say, for the really big players, that is always the case. There's always a way to or work something out, readjust the numbers, play around with interest rates, play around with money production. There's a way to do it. So what you see historically is that's always the case between the big players. But it's only when you have debts between the big players and the little players, between AIG and you, that suddenly debt is treated as this sacred obligation. How could you even imagine breaking that? Hmm. Or between a poor country and a rich country. I mean, if Madagascar owes money to the U.S., that's a sacred obligation. If the U.S. owes money to China, well, we can play around with that. And people are playing around with it all the time. So in a way, in 2008, they let the cat out of the bag. There were all these understandings that we had that, well, markets basically run themselves. Debts are sacred obligations. The big players are these incredible geniuses who know what they're doing, and they're the only people who know how to run an economy. So just shut up and let them do their thing. And we kind of realized that none of that was really true. And I think there's a kind of democratic awakening happening, and that's what's happened in places like Spain and Greece and has spread to the U.S. There's this realization that, like, no, this isn't true. Money is just a promise. It's just a social construct. It's something we make up. If banks can lend us money, it's not because they have that money. It's because we, the people, have given them the right to make up money. Well, if that is the situation, we've given them the right to make up money because we think it'll help people have houses. It'll help the economy grow. Economy isn't growing. People don't have houses. Something went wrong. We can change that around because it really comes from us to begin with. So I think people were saying if democracy is to mean anything, it has to mean that everybody can weigh in on that process of deciding what kind of promises we make and what kind of promises we readjust when we have to do that.
Hmm. Now, you are typically identified as an anarchist, which I think in most people's minds conjures up images of chaos. You know, if you don't have a clear hierarchy of authority with leaders at the top, how are you going to get anything done? Is there an anarchist perspective on these questions of debt and income equality, inequality, and what's happening in these Occupy protests?
Well, the Occupy protests have started on anarchist principles in the sense that we believe in directly democratic process. We believe that the idea of direct action, is that we should act as if we are already living in a free society, which means a society in which you don't have anybody showing up with weapons and saying, shut up and do what you're told. What we find is that if people act purely on conscience and collectively, democratically, in terms of what they think is right, for example, show up at a park and say, we are the public, this is a public park, we should have the right to peacefully assemble here, people with weapons will show up. It rather startles people who think they're already living in a free society. So think that it would be possible to have a free society of that sort, one which is not ultimately enforced through weapons.
Hmm. Now, it would seem that perhaps another sort of anarchist element in the Occupy Wall Street protests is, I mean, people are always asking, you know, what does this movement want? Where's the list of demands? Is that the wrong question?
Well, it is the wrong question in the sense that when you make a series of demands, what you're saying is we want to be part of the system. We are appealing to the people in power to do something for us. We want them to behave differently, but we assume that they are the people who are going to be solving our problems. The reason people held back from a list of demands at the beginning is that draws you into a certain sort of politics where you essentially get absorbed into the existing structure. Well, what the people at the Occupy Wall Street movement are basically saying as their start point is the existing structure is inherently corrupt. It's not a democratic system. It claims to be a democratic system, and I suppose it has a few moderate democratic elements. You get to vote occasionally. But really, it's a system where you select between one or two people who've already been selected by people with big money and who are ultimately going to be answerable to big money. Big money controls both political parties, and appealing to those guys is pointless.
Which raises the question then of what do these people at Occupy Wall Street want? I mean, obviously, they're pointing out what they see to be the inequity of society and of, you know, that top 1%. But where do you go from there?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is introduce the notion of what democracy would actually be like. We pride ourselves on being a democratic society, perhaps the most or greatest democratic society that has ever existed. But how many Americans have had the experience of sitting down with a bunch of other people and coming to a democratic decision together? We almost never do it. Maybe when ordering a pizza. So we're trying to introduce democratic institutions. Now, where that goes, that's a very interesting question, but it's a very thrilling thing for almost anyone. I was thrilled when I first became involved with it. I didn't realize it was possible for thousands of people to sit around and make democratic decisions. Now, in terms of what larger effects that's going to have, well, we don't want to legitimate the existing system. We want the existing system to try to legitimate itself to us. Because we're the people. We don't have to prove anything to them. Now, we're not going to do that by saying, we recognize you as the authorities and here's what we want you to do. We want to do that by saying, you have delegitimated yourself as democratic authorities. You are not that. If you want to go off and try to prove that you are, well, great. Maybe you can do that. That's what normally happens with social movements. You know, social movements that are successful don't start by coming up with a plan and then lobbying because it's totally stacked against them. What they do is they frighten the people in power with the prospect of actual democracy breaking out in this country because nothing frightens the people running this country more than the prospect of actual democracy breaking out. If you look at the civil rights movement, which also used this sort of direct democracy, horizontal politics, civil disobedience, direct action, consensus process. It terrified the people in power and very quickly caused them to make all sorts of concessions. If you look at the anti-nuclear movement in the 70s, the global justice movement, in each case, we achieved our aims much more quickly than we expected. And it was largely because we didn't fall back on this conventional politics of lobbying our leaders to do something different. We frightened them, not by an uprising in the sense of anything violent at all, but by the prospect of real democracy and democratic institutions emerging.
David Graeber is the author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years. He teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and was one of the founders of Occupy Wall Street. Steve Paulson spoke with him.